Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sustainable Finance Podcast. My name is Paul Ellis, and I'm your host for these programs about developments in this fast-growing industry. How should energy transition investors and policymakers think about the role of technologies like green hydrogen and energy storage systems, and what policy frameworks are needed to de-risk investment in them that will accelerate the energy transition? This is especially true of supply chain risks when financing critical minerals projects and nature-based solutions like voluntary carbon markets. Tokolo Matsabu and Pat Long Advisory work with companies like Ort Energy to globally deploy the company's revolutionary electrolyzer technology and make clean, green hydrogen economically viable in international markets. Today, Sustainable Finance Podcast followers will also learn about Pat Long Advisory's role to the Lesotho Foreign Ministry on energy and sustainable finance policy initiatives. Hello, Tokolo, and welcome to the Sustainable Finance Podcast.
Hi, Paul. Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yes, well, listen, we're going to jump right in with the policy question, and we want to find out what policy frameworks are needed to de-risk investment in emerging technologies like green hydrogen, energy storage, and distributed energy systems?
So, Paul, the challenge isn't just creating the policies, it's also creating consistent policies that investors can actually count on. For example, take the U.S. hydrogen sector right now. House Republicans are proposing to gut the 45V clean energy tax credit, which is, you know, rolling back its expiration from 2033 to 2026. This creates exactly the wrong signal, where I'm working with a startup company, Ort Energy, and we are deploying revolutionary electrolyzer technology that has an 87% efficiency versus the next best competitor, which is about 75. And we're forecasting to achieve under 1.5 pounds per kilogram hydrogen production by 2526 and basically reaching cost parity with green hydrogen. I'm fundraising for them and breaking them into international markets, like, for example, Namibia, South Africa, expanding other European markets, and then of course the Middle East, like Saudi Arabia and Oman, because all of those countries are bullish. And so I think the US market is a little bit trickier because of the sort of like flip that the new administration has done. So I think we need three core frameworks. It's regulatory certainty, financial de-risking, and market creation for the US at least. On the regulatory side, we have to have harmonized certification standards, which are really crucial. A hydrogen project shouldn't really be facing completely different requirements when scaling from one jurisdiction to another. So for financial de-risking, I think long-term policy commitments matter more than the size of individual incentives. So, for example, we could probably use the UK's contracts for the model for offshore wind, which shows how price certainty can unlock massive private investment. So basically, they secure a specific price for renewable energy over 15 years. And so we could probably see if we can implement that here in the United States. But this is where it gets interesting. We also need some frameworks for distributed energy systems like virtual power plants. So I wrote about virtual power plants for the cool down, exploring how they can pull together energy from smaller sources like rooftop solar, wind turbines, and storage batteries. And they use this AI aggregation software to create like a larger clean energy network. So they can deploy energy to places that are lacking. So they've actually trialed this in the north sort of eastern New England states, and they managed to do it over a summer linking three states, which is very interesting. I use the example in the article if you want to check that out. So these systems don't only need grid integration policies to the existing electric grid that we have, but that also compensates all of them for the services that they provide. So it's not just energy generation, for example, but grid balancing and resilience too. So a lot of different policy instruments are kind of working together, and I hope we can achieve some of those in the U.S. despite some of the political turn on this.
Okay, well, that's a good start. And what we want to do now is move the conversation in the direction of critical minerals. So, Tokolo, sustainable investment in critical mineral, resource-rich mining is needed to de-risk operations and mobilize more capital for upstream production and processing across a number of advanced energy technologies. What are the biggest supply chain risks that investors should consider when financing critical mineral projects?
So I think it's very important to look at geopolitical concentration. So I'm a political economist by training, and I've done analysis across Africa and the global South. And so geopolitical risk is very poorly quantified in financial models at the moment. We are seeing this play out right now. For example, the New York Times had an article today on the fact that now we have a magnet shortage because of the, you know, export restrictions that China has put on rare earths. So it's affecting everything from wind turbines to electric vehicles. It's not just where the minerals are mined, but it's also where they're processed. So the midstream is really important. That poses the biggest geopolitical risk, because China processes, in some cases, 100% of some of these minerals. So even if the lithium comes from Australia, if it's processed in China, you also have that concentration risk. That's what I call it. Then there's infrastructure inadequacy in resource-rich regions, which kills projects. There are some great deposits, for example, in Africa that fail, not because of the geology, but because of ports, power grids, or transport networks that couldn't handle the scale. So in Africa, for example, this can add about 20 to 30% of the cost of investments. Then we have resource nationalism, which isn't inherently negative. We all know that countries should benefit from their mineral wealth, especially when you have the context of the historical sort of extractive relationship that global North countries have had with the global South. But investors do need predictable frameworks around tax regimes and local content requirements. So I think Norway's oil model shows how that we could do resource nationalism right. And we just have to do the research and apply it to the specific context of the specific countries. And then the last one I definitely think is social license to operate is now a material financial risk. So ESG requirements from downstream buyers mean that community acceptance is going to affect market access and not just operational stability. So projects that skip early community engagement are going to face stranded asset risk. But also, if you sort of see how the EU is applying the carbon border adjustments now with carbon emissions, they're also doing that, for example, with the sourcing of key minerals. So, like, if there are human rights violations or environmental risks or deforestation, you cannot get into the EU market, which is super important.
All right. So now we're talking about carbon sequestration, right? In some markets, as we expand in that direction as well. What are the biggest challenges in mobilizing capital for nature-based solutions globally?
I think the fundamental challenge is fitting complex ecosystem services into actual financial instruments that are designed for industrial assets. So from the carbon sequestration work that I do and looking into the policy and regulatory frameworks in order to actually implement my projects, I see three major barriers. One is measurement and verification. It definitely tops the list. Unlike, for example, solar panels, which easily measured the output, quantifying carbon sequestration or biodiversity impacts involves significant uncertainty and monitoring costs. Investors struggle with these assets when it comes to where the product can't really be precisely measured. I think there's also temporal mismatches between ecological and financial timescales, which create another barrier. So forest carbon projects, for example, deliver returns over 30 to 50 years, but most funds operate on 5 to 10 year horizons. So we need more patient capital structures to help bridge this gap. Then revenue concentration risk is often overlooked. Many projects depend heavily on volatile carbon credit sales. We need more diversified revenue streams, maybe bundling carbon with biodiversity credits, water services, or even tourism revenue. So the solution requires blended finance, whether it's grants for development and concessional debt for infrastructure, market rate equity for operations, plus standardized measurement protocols and longer-term policy commitments.
Now, what opportunities do you see in the interim term, let's say in the next 5 to 10 years, for developing nations to participate meaningfully in global carbon finance? And you've already mentioned a couple of the barriers that need to be removed. Are there any more?
You know, I think it touches on a fundamental issue, like climate justice questions that we've grappled with across Africa. So developing nations have these natural assets essential for global climate goals, but current structures often extract the value without building local capacity. So another one is capacity building for project development. That's the foundational barrier. For example, you know, we have a regulatory sort of environment in global north countries. And so it's a lot easier to have, we have established markets in like California, you know, compliance and more voluntary markets. Whereas, you know, most carbon finance flows to these projects are developed by international consultants. So we need more technical assistance that actually builds domestic capacity for project identification and implementation, not just, you know, global north sourced, and not just the training for that, but also helping developing countries create local institutions that can actually compete for climate finance. For example, I mean, I'm piloting some of these projects in Lesotho, and they don't really have a carbon market or structured carbon market or sort of finance. They've looked into it, but yeah, they don't really have the institutional for it. And so one of the things that I'm doing, aside from attracting investments for them, is helping them build a sort of institutional framework that can also maybe link into South Africa's existing carbon markets that they're scaling up. I think value chain integration represents the biggest opportunity. So instead of just selling raw carbon credits, developing countries should capture value through processing, bundling, and retail. So for example, Rwanda's coffee market transformation provides a really good model, moving just from commodity exports to branded processed products. I am also piloting in Lesotho hemp to biochar, which of course many products can be made out of hemp, and using that biomass waste, you put it in this cool biochar machine, and that actually, you know, injects it back into the soil, which is a proper carbon farming technique that actually has carbon removal properties. So I also wrote another article on the cool down on what is carbon removal. So you can go check that out. But biochar specifically has some of the highest credit value. It can be anywhere between $100 to $150. Obviously, carbon markets are fluctuating, but sort of that's the kind of calculations that we bring. So a paradigm shift is needed from aid-based approaches to investment partnerships, where developing countries are equity partners in global climate solutions, not just service providers. This requires international climate finance capacity building and institution development, not just the project financing. And the last little point that I say is regional development banks and guarantee mechanisms can help bridge the risk perception gaps by providing some local knowledge as well as risk mitigation.
Listen, risk mitigation is one of the things that a lot of the people that we talk to on the podcast are focusing on, especially in these developing markets, as you're suggesting. So we're dealing now with geopolitical tensions on a global basis and geoeconomic shifts, which are reshaping international energy cooperation and climate finance flows. What are you thinking right now about how that can be accelerated and how especially countries in the global south can participate more actively in these markets?
So I think investors need to assess geopolitical risk and integrate it more into the financial models. Of course, that's going to take, you know, initial political economy and geopolitical experts in order to advise on how to do that. But eventually investors will have their own internal capacity to have those analysts to understand this. So we're witnessing a fundamental restructuring of energy geopolitics that will define climate finance for the next decade. The Russia-Ukraine conflict also has accelerated some of these trends, which is mostly energy security focus, which is already, you know, another one emerging from US-China competition, of course. Energy security is now driving climate investments in ways that pure climate policy couldn't really achieve. So Europe's Repower EU represents one of the largest climate investment programs in European history, but it's motivated by energy security, not just emissions. This creates opportunities for strategic climate partnerships between energy importing and resource-rich countries. Critical minerals geopolitics is creating new resource diplomacy. So we're seeing this in Chile's lithium strategy, for example, Indonesia's nickel processing requirements, and the DRC's cobalt policies. And then, of course, you know, China just restricting rare earth exports to the United States, which is now causing a shortage in magnets. And we're going to now see that sort of implications of the US-China competition now start to play out in our supply chains. So a very interesting time that we're in. But this type of resource nationalism will reshape supply chains and create opportunities for countries offering stable, diversified supply. Technology competition is fragmenting global climate finance. So the US Inflation Reduction Act subsidies, they used to have these domestic content requirements, but China dominates on the manufacturing side. So this creates now a pressure for the United States to friendshore a lot of their clean energy supply chains, friendshoring, of course, you know, sourcing from Australia instead of another country that is a foreign adversary. But again, bearing in mind that it's all processed in China, I think what the US overlooks is that they actually need to build up more processing capacity domestically. South-to-South cooperation is emerging as a counterweight. China's Belt and Road Initiative, for example, Brazil's biofuels diplomacy, India's International Solar Alliance represent alternative models which bypass traditional multilateral institutions. I mean, the implication is more regionalization and securitization. So more strategic climate partnerships, which bundle climate objectives, need to happen with energy security as well as economic development. So it's not just climate goals, it's all of these solutions as well.
You know, Tukolo, you're talking, we've talked already this morning about so many different complex issues related to the energy transition spread around the world in the global north and the global south, and how all of this is going to eventually work out into a new clean energy infrastructure around the world. And you were also taking some steps through the creation of the Clean Energy Corps that you've launched to deploy college graduates into rural communities for installation of solar energy and carbon sequestration projects. I'm assuming you're doing that domestically initially, but maybe around the world as well eventually, because we need the next generation to be educated and prepared for this transition, right?
100%. Actually, I'm piloting it in Africa, in Lesotho, because it's a much more smaller environment where we can learn a lot more. However, I'm working on a proposal to try this with tribal communities here domestically. So my pilot is going to be in Lesotho, and then the pilot here will be with tribal communities because they're the most need, last mile communities, and most underserved you know, populations of our country. So the Clean Energy Corps is roughly based on the Peace Corps model, which, as most of you know, it deploys college graduates to communities to live in them for 2 years around the world to dissolve development challenges. I think Peace Corps is now under threat, if I'm not mistaken, from being cut. So that's not really ideal, but it addresses a critical gap, Clean Energy Corps, that, you know, we have an abundant renewable energy potential, an educated youth in some cases, but limited pathways to connecting them to meaningful sort of climate actions careers. So it is first and foremost a workforce development sort of initiative when it comes to Africa specifically, because we pay for the training and certification. And then, of course, there's a very strong community economic development component. So we deploy recent graduates, first focusing on STEM, for example, but we'll expand to other college graduates as well for a 12 to 18 month service program in rural and last mile communities, where they also not just do solar energy and installation, but they create carbon credit projects to, you know, maintain the financial sustainability of the energy systems, because a lot of these sort of clean energy rural type projects sometimes fail because, you know, they need to replace the solar panels and batteries in a few years, and there's no money to do that. So it's not just about technology deployment, it's also about local capacity building and community ownership. So core fellows work directly with the community leaders to identify the energy needs, conduct feasibility assessments, and then implement the solutions, where we focus a lot then on sort of agriculture and soil-based carbon projects. So as I mentioned earlier, hemp to biochar is one of the ones that we're piloting. We're also piloting another project that uses seeds and agriculture tech from US companies, where they export it into these communities and there's a sort of technology transfer impact. We also have US economies and the ag industry benefiting from some of those exports. So, you know, the program creates a triple impact where graduates gain the practical skills in the green economy, rural communities get energy access and climate resilience, and we build a pipeline of locally trained clean energy professionals who understand what community needs are. So yeah, I've launched that and it's a very cool initiative. So if anyone is interested in getting involved or finding out more, you can go to my website.
Well, listen, we have a couple of companies that we have done podcast programs with in the past that I want to refer to you for engagement in this program, because it sounds terrific. And I know that you want to get it started very quickly and accelerate the pace of getting young people engaged in it. And that's what we want to see as well. So finally, Tokolo, you're recruiting also corporate founding members for the International Development Collective, or the IDC, which is a pioneering think tank and social impact incubator designed to address critical gaps in the international development funding of all of these types of projects that we've discussed. So how can corporations participate in the IDC, and how can they get in touch with you to learn more about it, as well as all the other programs that you are developing?
So with the collapse of USAID, I launched the International Development Collective. I had just finished my Master of Science in Global Energy and Climate Policy. And so, you know, you're back in the actual full-time career things. And, you know, USAID collapsed, and it also emerged from a general frustration where brilliant development solutions fail to either scale or they don't make the intended impact because of funding gaps and misaligned incentives between traditional donors and the market and market needs. So I basically launched the IDC to help nonprofits specifically access private sector funding and private capital, because now a lot of these institutions that have lost USAID funding now don't really know how to communicate and position themselves to explain to private capital why this actually achieves their sort of CSR goals or ESG goals or sustainable finance goals. So we're looking for corporates to engage as founding members to co-create solutions together rather than just writing checks. So we focus on areas where market-based approaches can address development challenges, particularly in climate resilience, energy access, and sustainable finance. This participation model is an equity-based engagement. Founding members contribute both to the financial resources and expertise. We'll be putting on webinars, for example. We're developing an entire curriculum as well. We'll be developing knowledge management resources from the different projects that corporates participate in. So I'm currently recruiting my board members, which I have about 10 at the moment, who are experts from the private sector, international development space, development financing, the works. It's multidisciplinary. And we're recruiting companies across energy, finance, technology, agriculture, and any corporate who would like to participate in, you know, development objectives and projects around the world that are actually sustainable and can possibly deliver a physical return on their investment.
Terrific. So where online can followers of the Sustainable Finance Podcast go to learn more about Pat Long Advisory, and how can they get in touch with you with questions that they have about the topics that we've discussed in today's podcast episode?
So you can find more information about this at www.patlongadvisory.org. I have a specific tab for the International Development Collective as well. My email is teeks@patlongadvisory.org. I am extremely active on LinkedIn. I'm there every day, check it first thing in the morning, last thing at night. So LinkedIn, my LinkedIn profile is very, very useful, as I also share a lot of energy insights and, you know, leverage the network. So you can also send me a direct message there.
Great. Now, you also may have mentioned a couple of papers, documents, reports that you have put together, blogs or whatever. We're glad to attach a couple of those documents to the podcast, and so that our followers can dig deeper into these topics, either before or after they contact you directly. So send us those, and we'll drop those along with the podcast episode.
And great. So it'll mostly just be my published articles via the Wilson Center on that addresses the ESG risks and critical mineral supply chains. And then a lot of the writing that I wrote for the cool down on, you know, I'll attach all of those, I guess, documents, but there's also links. And then also from my piece from Earth 911, where I talk about the recycling potential of critical minerals and how, you know, recycling can actually account for 20-30% of these minerals. So it's a big opportunity for the US to get on board and maybe, you know, table some legislation on that. If it's a bipartisan issue that both, you know, Democrats and Republicans can agree on when it comes to anything. So yes, let's see if we can take some action.
Terrific. Well, thanks again so much for your time today, Tokolo. And we encourage our followers to join us again next week for another episode. I'm Paul Ellis, and this is the Sustainable Finance Podcast.